You are listening to WCOM FM 103.5, Chapel Hill and Carrboro's community radio station. The comments, views, and opinions of the following program do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WCOM, its board, and underwriters. Today, the conversation is about diversity. It's about bias and prejudice in business relationships and capital access. It's a very current topic, and it is really important to understand that discrimination can mean discernment, and discrimination can mean prejudice. So the conversation we want to talk about today is, in part, making that distinction. Capital access can be critical. Well, not just can be, but it is critical to the success of every business. And one of the hardest lessons we have to learn, whether we're a young entrepreneur or a well-established one, whether we're white or black or any other ethnicity, whether we're men or women, the discrimination that we face should be only about discerning the best opportunities, the opportunities that will pay off. It's never supposed to be about anything other than a sound business model, a great idea, or even a good idea with a fantastic business model and team behind it. And that's what I want to kind of work through today. Bias perception is their reality. So I've experienced bias in my life. I grew up in West Virginia. I worked for a British automotive supplier here in North Carolina several decades ago now. But one of my bosses there would constantly make ethnic jokes about my family tree being a straight line, jokes about being surprised that I didn't walk with a limp because I grew up in the mountains. And he didn't understand what West Virginia was about. I like to say West Virginia is one of the best kept secrets in the United States. We don't get a lot of great PR, but we're a great place to be. And so whether we are white or black, male or female, or any other identity you want to claim, a lot of times people don't like us not because of something that's visible, but something about our behavior, our attitude. But when it comes to business, those prejudices, those biases, those things about personality don't really take prominence in the equation of who we're going to do business with and who we're going to fund and support, or at least they shouldn't. And so when we've had conversations about capital access, PPP loans and EIDL loans are the most recent discussions where minority businesses, women-owned businesses, and businesses from underserved communities didn't get a large portion of the funding. The question was it discrimination based on their minority status, their underserved community, or was it a business decision? Now, for the banks online who never met the applicants, they have a strong case that says, we didn't know their race. We didn't know their gender. We made a lending decision strictly based on the data, the facts, the information that was submitted. And that's where we need to start our conversation, is about the quality, the business literacy, the capabilities and the skill sets within those businesses, the tools that they need to be provided in order to have equal access to capital and to have unbiased evaluation of the opportunities. And so that's where the conversation starts today. This is Focus on Business, and I'm your host, Lee Strickland, and I hope you will join me for this hour as I wind my way through a very difficult topic: how to overcome bias and prejudice in business relationships and capital access, and defining what that bias really is. Is it discernment or is it discrimination? One of the key questions we have to ask is, what is bias? Bias perception. And we also have to admit that someone's perception is their reality, and how do we counter those perceptions? I've been working with several young entrepreneurs recently, and one of the hardest lessons for them is learning that everything isn't going to work the way you want it to. For instance, the people who have the money make the rules. You can't change their goals, their personalities, their processes, or their prejudices. You can't change their criteria for investing, and you can't change the tendency to overgeneralize, or what could be called once bitten, twice shy approach to investing. If an investment group or a bank or anyone else has had a bad experience with a certain category or demographic of people, there is the reluctance, the tendency to kind of overgeneralize, to apply a broad brush and say what that one representative of that group is or did, or how that investment came out, will indicate how others in that category will behave and how investments in those categories will turn out. It's not necessarily true. I may be white and female, and I may be a baby boomer. I grew up in West Virginia, and I've lived all over the country. I moved 11 times before I landed here in North Carolina a couple decades ago. And my experiences are very different from another woman who has been in the corporate world, who's white, who went through and got an MBA and an education and came from West Virginia, and all those demographics, all the psychographics, all the life experiences that come together. We're born with a certain type of personality, a certain drive, and we have certain experiences that help form who we are and how hard we fight. So I would no more say that a 55 or 56 year old white baby boomer from West Virginia that I went to elementary school or high school with or college with or even grad school with, that I would represent them accurately. If you were to take my behaviors and my capabilities and say, well, all 55-year-old white women from West Virginia with an MBA from Ohio State behave this way. It's not true. But that is our tendency. We tend to think our experiences are predictors in full, not just in part, of what we're going to experience with someone who looks like us or who sounds like us or who we've done business with in the past. So unfortunately, investors who have had bad experiences in a particular industry or with a specific founder demographic or with owner complexity, too many owners or too unsophisticated and experienced one, will be more cautious when they're evaluating potential investments that they view as similar. So if they're looking at a company run by a 20-something young woman with a degree from one of our local universities in, say, political science, and they're launching a manufacturing operation, and they've had someone of similar characteristics that is a 20-something woman launching a business in a similar field or industry that went wrong, then you may have to fight a little bit harder for them to take you seriously, to present your case, to consider you not similar to their past experience. While you may not think you are just like the company they're comparing you to or the founder that they're comparing you to, it's going to take time. It's going to take effort to educate and persuade them that you are different and why you're different. You're going to have to build a relationship. And that relationship starts out with a predisposition, a bias that they have toward 20-something female founding entrepreneurs who have never run a business, who have an interesting concept, and who may not be, well, generating that much revenue at this point. A lot of action, a lot of buzz, a lot of verve, but not a lot of traction. So we need to talk about glass walls and glass ceilings and those perceptions. And for this example, I'm going to continue with that young 20-something female entrepreneur looking for funding. There are glass walls and there are glass ceilings. Over two decades, I have been a consultant. I have been in corporate America for nearly 40 years. I got my first corporate job. I wasn't a waitress. I wasn't a cashier. I was an administrative assistant. Worked full-time in undergrad, partway through undergrad, paying tuition and books and expenses from those efforts. So I've been in business a long time. I've worked with many women-owned businesses and women executives. I've worked for women executives. And the conversations that we've had have been insightful and enlightening, but I've also found that, well, women who came up the hard way, who were on the front lines of battling through those glass walls and those glass ceilings, well, they are sometimes not the friendliest cheerleaders of the young 20-somethings, or even my generation as we were coming up over the past few decades, breaking some walls and ceilings. So one of my clients, we were having a discussion, and she suggested I should do one of my radio shows, then call it Girls and Grandmas, Too Young and Too Old to Succeed, the bias of blocking access to capital for women-owned businesses. Well, we've done some of those topics, but I've not done that specific one, and I think I will be doing that show in an upcoming program. But the reality is, we're all going to encounter some kind of bias or prejudice, whether that's from an upbringing, a generational thing, whether it's perceptions that are built by media bias and aren't reality. It may be deliberate bias. Someone may just not like a certain demographic or category, and if they have the money, well, they don't have to invest their money. It's a private transaction. But there is a lot of unconscious bias out there, and that is undoubtedly has been some systematic and outright discrimination in funding decisions. I know I have walked into meeting rooms and, well, in corporate America and since starting my consulting practice and been the only woman in the room, and everyone's shocked because somehow my name got misspelled on the documents and they were expecting a man, and I am not a man. But that bias was quickly overcome. It was shifted and changed when the conversation started, when they realized I was an expert and that my gender had nothing to do with that expertise. So the majority of bias is unconscious. Is it systemic? Is it outright discrimination? Is it intentional? Well, for some people, yes, unfortunately. But that's not the majority of people you're going to encounter. So when we look at our businesses, whether it's going to make a decision, whether we're the investor or the investee, whether we're hiring someone or being hired, there's a lot of unconscious bias. And it's mainly comes from us wanting to be comfortable with the people we're around and understand them. And we used to refer to that as halo effect whenever someone was interviewing a candidate. And because that candidate looked like them and sounded like them and had similar backgrounds and shared some values, that candidate seemed in the mind of the interviewer to be the best candidate. When you might dig down and find that they weren't the best candidate, they weren't the most skilled, they didn't have the most experience, they didn't really even fit the job, but that haloing effect, that liking them and feeling comfortable with them could override the wise decision making, the right discernment, the right kind of discrimination in making the decision as to who they're going to hire. And sometimes it's language patterns. Not being able to understand the slang, the lingo, the dialect, the tone, the cadence of how someone's speaking. And knowing that language and communication is critical to success, that can put up a barrier, or maybe it's an unconscious barrier, because they're concerned that they're not going to be able to connect and communicate and make things happen the way they need to happen in the time they want to happen. It might take too much effort to have someone not like them in the room. And in funding, that's called pattern matching. That's what, and whatever name you give it, the behavior is essentially choosing whom to do business with, hire, and fund based on how similar they are to us. In other words, we unconsciously interact and give benefit to people who most closely resemble us physically, philosophically, and in other aspects. It's like going to church. You don't go to have your ideas challenged. You go to find some place that you feel at home at and comfortable with. And so while you may grow and mature more in your faith and your religious beliefs and your discipline and your understanding, if you go to a church that challenges you, you choose to go where you find comfort and where it's easier to be. So for an industry like venture capital that in 2018 was 82% male and 70% white, the bias, that haloing effect, that pattern matching impact is significant. But again, that's self-limiting for these people. And they're disconnected. They're disconnected ventures and angel groups, because we're realizing that women have, and minorities and diversity in our businesses have a significant impact and are more successful. So there are many studies out there that have demonstrated that businesses that are led by diverse leadership teams and founders that include women and minorities outperform the competition, in part because they see things differently. They deliver higher returns to investors. There's a McKinsey study out there that's been cited many times that revealed that companies deliver through diversity. And it's actually delivering through diversity, and I'm putting that in quotes. Companies that are led by ethnic, gender, and culturally diverse teams of founders are found to be 15% more likely to generate profitability that is the highest quartile, the top 25% of businesses in their category. So it's not just good business to have diversity from an industry standpoint. It's great to have businesses that are diverse, that are led by people that don't look like you or sound like you, that don't match your patterns. So it is just good business to diversify from an industry standpoint and a founder leadership standpoint. So what's at stake? Well, the stakes for funders and for the people they would invest in is great. That capital access, that gap between the great ideas and the good ideas, and the opportunities that are being missed, because funders need to understand that this generation of founders, the 20-somethings, is unlikely to accept discrimination of any type, intentional or unconscious, quietly. And I've seen one local young entrepreneur take to social media to share her experience with the old boys club that she ran into and talk about the struggle of being young and female and innovative and a powerhouse determined to make something happen. But on the flip side, she still has a lot to learn and she needs to listen. But she laid it all out there on social media. The question will be, does it reflect badly on her? Does it reflect badly on the funding groups? Well, this generation is going to have significant platforms for gaining support and communicating their issues, and funders are going to have to tread carefully and realize that how they say things and to whom they're saying them and the justifications they're giving for passing over an investment because someone looks like someone else that they had a bad experience with is not going to be an accepted rejection. They have to make their case and they have to communicate. Yes, it's their money and they don't have to invest in you. But they also have to tread carefully and not be saying anything that could lead to a charge of discrimination. So this current generation of young entrepreneurs that are coming up, male and female, ethnically diverse, diverse backgrounds, diverse schooling. Some are college graduates and some have not even stepped foot in college and may have even dropped out of high school. They're innovative, they're young, they're current, they're hungry, they're connected, and they have the power of social media behind them. This diverse group of founders may cost you as a funding group more than just a missed opportunity for investment. They could impact your business reputation and your viability. So if your organization lacks diversity and you're a funding organization, it's past time to diversify. If you're not investing broadly, it's past time to diversify. You may need to recruit women and minorities into your investor group. You may also want to bring in consultants and advisors that guide your organization in developing self-awareness of your unconscious biases, of your language and your business practices that are perpetuating systemic discrimination, intentionally or not. So yes, experience matters. For decades, I've worked in, for, and with businesses that lack leadership diversity. And one of my earliest experiences with a diversity committee was while at a major corporation. They initiated a recruiting program to increase diversity in that business. And I was tagged as one of the rising women in the corporation to host a lot of the candidates coming in. But they didn't quite understand diversity, even though their diversity committee looked to be diverse to the eye. But despite that, the visible variety in that committee from an ethnic and cultural background, some being born here in this country and some being born overseas, they didn't have any women on that committee. And that was one major gap. But the other thing was that despite the visible variety in their group, they didn't get what it really meant to recruit and embrace diversity. One of the executives asked me a very telling question about one of the female candidates that I hosted. She was female, she was minority, she was foreign born, and she was a powerhouse. She would have been great for the company. But the question he asked, do you think she can fit into our company culture? Did you read between the lines of that question? Well, just in case, I'm going to paraphrase what I said back to him. It's like, oh, do you think she can transform to behave like an old white guy? And I actually pretty much said that to him because that was really what he was asking. They brought in diverse groups of people and then asked them to behave within the structures that had been created systemically for decades, nearly a century at that time. They didn't quite realize that diversity meant being able to have different opinions, different perspectives, to challenge the structures and the systems and the way things have always been done. Diversity was more than about being about skin color or where someone was born. It was about thought. It was about process. It was about opinions. It was about having a mix of backgrounds and expertise and experiences coming in. So diversity is more than about gender and skin color and demographics and psychographics. It's about how we do things. It's about, well, the United States for centuries was known as the place of the American dream. And part of that American dream was because we were called a melting pot. We came in from different countries, from Ireland, from England, from Scotland and Germany and India and China and Japan and different countries in South America and Africa. Everyone came here, Russian. My aunt was from Austria. I have cousins that were from India. And so we came from all these different countries and we came here and brought that diversity, and our country, being a melting pot, took the best of everything and brought it together to be innovative. That diversity of cultures, of experiences, of languages coming together brought food. It brought so many different things and so many different perspectives on how to do business and how to be creative. Andrew Carnegie, born in Scotland and came here and made such a difference. And what we can just point around the country to immigrants, immigrant entrepreneurs even today that come into Louisiana and are running fishing businesses, to different parts of the country and start restaurants or own hotels or bed and breakfasts or create, you know, out in Hollywood creating innovative independent films. That culture, that difference that came in and took what structures that were meant to be the best, not perfect, but enabled us to become whatever we wanted to be. We had equal access to education. Not always the same quality. And I will say education in a lot of the countries, part of the country, have declined over the years because there is no choice and there is no competition. And that's a conversation we've had on other shows and we can have in future shows. But if you want to talk about diversity, we have to embrace what was different and come together and recognize what is the same and how we do that. And English used to be a common language around the world that seemed to be a language that was easier to communicate in. And because of science, because of aviation, because of a lot of industries originating here in the States, that English became the common language around the world. And by having that common language that didn't say forget your roots, forget your first language, it just meant having English as a second language. And have another language as your second language. Maybe it's Spanish, it's French, it's Chinese, it's Arabic, it's Italian. But finding another language and having experienced that and understanding those differences. Our country, the United States, has been so wonderful for so many and is still the dream place to immigrate to because the rules applied equally to everyone. Now, are there cops out there? Are there different people in different industries that are biased and prejudiced and do the wrong things? Yes, no one's going to deny that. But that 1% shouldn't tar and feather the other 99%. And so if we want to be diverse, we have to come together and blend our voices and take our backgrounds that make us stronger and bring them in to create systems and processes and solutions and technology that are different and that make the most of what's the best in each person and meld it into our culture, our perspectives, our decision-making, and every aspect of how our businesses operate, how our organizations operate. It isn't enough to look diverse. You have to be diverse. So what should founders and their executive teams do? First and foremost, they have to realize that all funding is not created equal. And if you are dealing with bias in obtaining funding, then don't expect that bias to disappear if you do get funded. You're going to be fighting an uphill battle, and you're going to be educating people. And I'm going to flash back not to a funding situation, but to a business situation that, again, it was a major corporation I was at just out of grad school, and I was working there. And I had a really great relationship with the leadership team of that organization. And one of the things I'd like to do was ask them why decisions were made on promotions, hiring, things that you would normally not get to ask. And I was blessed to be mentored by, you know, 5 or 6 men in that organization that were at the top of the organization that when I asked them things, they would answer. And when I challenged them about things, they would answer and they would actually listen to it. And I can contrast my experience with a woman who started the same day I did, and they didn't have the same degree of confidence and respect in her, whether it was her attitude or mannerisms. It wasn't because she was female, because if that was true, they wouldn't have been mentoring me. But there was something different there. And so one of the conversations I had with the leadership team was when a position came open. And I sat and went through every person I thought could be a candidate for that position and tried to guess who they were going to interview and who they were going to promote. And I was blown out of the water because it was definitely one of those haloing effects. Somebody that they liked got promoted. And I went in and I knocked on one of the key manager's doors. I said, can I talk to you? I want to understand something. He said, sure, come in and sit down. What is it? I said, well, I made a list of all the candidates in this organization that I thought should be up for that position that you just promoted someone to. And he's like, yeah. He said, well, who was on your list? And I said, well, I don't understand. I said, I went through credentials and things. And he goes, well, who was on your list? And I'm like, and I started listing off. Well, Peggy was on there and Chris was on there. And he's looking at me and I started listing off and he got this look on his face and he's like, Peggy. I said, she wasn't on your list? He's like, no. Chris, she wasn't on your list? No. And my list of top 20 candidates had 7 women on the list. And when I went through their credentials and stuff, and he said, I hate to admit it, their names didn't even come up in the conversations. And I'm like, what was your process for looking through the organization for the candidates? And he said, well, we all sat in the room and we threw out the names that, you know, were most prominent in our minds. I said, you didn't systematically look at who was in the organization in different positions, who were assistants to this position, and how long they'd been here and their background and their experience, and that they, and he said, we should have, obviously. And I said, you know, let's even think about and get this grounded in your mind even stronger. And I want you to ask this question to the rest of the leadership team, if you will. All of you have daughters. How would you have felt if your daughter comes home one of these days and says, Dad, I didn't even get considered from the job because they didn't put any women on the list? Now, yes, this was nearly 30 years ago, but I think it still happens today when we don't have a systematic process, when we don't sit down and look at the options and the candidates. It's easy to halo effect, to pattern match, and promote the people that we play golf with, or promote the person that we have the most in common with, and we're going to overlook the best candidates. So if there is bias with who you're doing business with, or if you run into someone who is biased in some way, and I always said this in corporate, if I can't deal directly with the bias, if I can't have it overthrown, bypassed, addressed, then there are lots of other places to work. If I am in business and I can't get funding at one place, I will go somewhere else where I can. If I have people discriminating against my business because I'm too strong-willed of a woman to work with, that's fine. There are a lot of other women to work with, and there are a lot of other organizations and men to work with who don't have a problem with it. So we have to, in businesses, in our organization, realize that we're going to make decisions. And if we choose to engage with people who have biases and prejudices, who discriminate, not discern, then we're going to be dealing with them long term. Some people we can educate. Some people we can overcome. And no one is hopeless. But it takes a lot. And you have to endure a lot. And you have to have conversations that are tough. And you have to decide at some point, are the trade-offs worth it? Is taking money from that person going to be the best thing for your business? Is going into business with that person going to be the best thing for your business? I've been called kiddo, honey, sweetheart, darling, baby, and any number of things. I've been asked if I was, how old I was. Was I going to be married? Did I have children? And I can go on and on the questions I've been asked over the decades of my career in my business. But it's also fun to be told you're the only woman candidate for this position and you're competing against all these other organizations, and the only reason you're even being considered is because we had to have women candidates for this contract. And so don't expect to get it because you're too young and you're female. And that's fine. And I said, that was fine, I understood. And then I went out and I competed as me, as a female, as the expert, and did it differently than the people I was competing against. And you know what? Contrary to popular belief, contrary to the biases of that particular client and that particular country that didn't like to hire women and certainly didn't like to have women consultants from the United States come in and tell them what was wrong with their business. You know what? They did. And it was a great engagement. And were there issues with it? Did they have to learn how to deal with a strong-willed American woman? Yeah, they did. But my expertise put me head and shoulders above the people that they could have worked with. And that's not prejudice. That's not ego. That's what they said. And that's why they hired me. So when we're out there, we have to realize some bias can be overcome strictly by the strength of our character, our ideas, our ability to do business, our expertise, and our business models. Other bias is not going to go away no matter how good you are. And that bias may ultimately cost you your business. So you may want to take the establishment's bias into consideration. And if you want to go for it, I say go for it. However, recognize that a single conversation, no matter how enlightening, can change long-held patterns of behavior. If you want to tilt at windmills, if you want to beat your head against a brick wall, or if you just want to see how far you can go in changing them, then go for it. But even with the best of intentions, individuals and their organizations easily slide back into old habits. I've been experiencing this with a new project I've been working on, and the consultant has loads of experience in the industry, and I want that experience. The unfortunate part is he doesn't get the new diversity initiative, the diversity need for what we're doing and how we're designing this new organization. And he nods his head. He says, yes, we have these wonderful conversations about why diversity has to be taken into consideration in every aspect of what we're doing. And then he slips back into the patterns of introducing me to people who look just like him. And he's not bad looking, but he is the traditional white guy in the room, and that's all he's bringing to the table. And I like the white guys. Don't get me wrong. My dad was a white guy. My brother's a white guy. My family's predominantly made up of white guys, as are a lot of my friends and my business associates. They're great. They bring something to the table, and a lot of times it's money and personality and experience and expertise. But they have to be able to change how they think if they want to be engaged in this particular project that we're launching. And so bias can come back. And I admit, I have a tendency that when I look at certain people, when I run into them, I kind of expect and hope I'm going to be disappointed that their perspective is not going to be more of a diversity focused, that they are not going to get what we're doing. And a lot of people tell me that's not just because of their background or their ethnic group or their demographic or their gender or their experience. It's just that when you're innovating, it takes a while for people to see those new models and those new way of doing things. And so that's something to really understand. If you're willing to keep having conversations over and over with those individuals and those organizations, you may eventually get them to get it and get them to change. But it may be better to walk away. So that's the second point to talk about. If you need funding, you have to be willing to walk away from bad money, money with too many strings, with too much prejudice behind it, that will rear their ugly head over and over again, that may slow you down or even make you wait to take the next step in your business because they may set a higher standard for you to hit, a bigger milestone for you to hit, or less time for you to get to a certain point than your business is going to be able to support, just because they want more confidence before they take the next step. So from experience, I'm going to tell you that minority and women-owned businesses have regretted not waiting for the right funders that valued their diversity and their capabilities. And why? Well, the people with the money set the timelines, the milestones, and the strategies. They're going to put somebody on your board at least. I've seen organizations where they put in the money and said, looked at the founder and had brought it and created the science and had brought the company to, you know, a multi-million dollar company already, and looked at this, in this particular, it was a woman, and told her, well, one of the conditions of the money is we're going to bring in a CEO. He has experience. And I remember getting the call and meeting her for lunch. And she said, I've looked at this guy's resume. He has never successfully run any business from this stage forward. He has all 13, and it was an unlucky 13, all 13 businesses he's been brought in on have failed in this phase that he's supposed to be leading. And she goes, why would I let him come and run my business that I've taken all this time, that I put all this blood, sweat, and tears into, and all of my money into? And I said, that's a good question. Why would you? The only reason would be is that money is so important to your next step that you're willing to take on a failed, serially failed CEO. And she says, I'm not willing to do that. And I said, then that's the right answer. You may go slower. It may take longer, but it's your company, and I think you're still going to get there, and if you keep looking for the right money, you're going to find somebody who will invest in your business and will let you lead it until the business has outgrown your skill set. And so the people who bring the money determine who will run the business. So if you take that check a long time, they're going to start calling shots on executive team members and how you recruit, who you recruit, and who they expect you to hire. they're going to impact the next round of funding, and too often they transform this business that you founded into a completely different company, one that more resembles the funders than the founders. So when we look into the future about diversity, ultimately in capital access, both the funders and the founders have to work together to transform the access to capital for every business. If you want to help change the system, then you have to be willing to make some tough calls when it comes to who you choose to fund your business. I tell my client companies that you want to grow and run the business you found. If you want the innovations and the reasons why you created the business to last past the first round of funding, then you have to be careful who you take money from. If you aren't committed to ensuring that your change continues beyond the first round of funding, it's your call. But if you are committed to sustaining the innovation and the change that you've created, then you need to guard your business like a mama bear with her cubs. You may have to work lean and a little longer. You may have to take a little more time to get to your long-term goal. But in the long run, your impact on the world will last far beyond the early stages of your business if you stay true to the business you founded. Now, there are growth things that we don't know when we're in this phase. And that's why having a diverse set of advisors around you is important. To hear that expertise from the old white guy, or the old white woman, or the black entrepreneur, Hispanic entrepreneur that's been down this path and bootstrapped their business to multi-millions or even billions. We have to look beyond funding bias and broken business models to the destruction of innovation and successful business models. And that's not been limited to early stage companies and to funders. We can look back over decades to companies that did mergers and acquisitions, as well as businesses that grew their business models that put them on the map. I'm old enough to remember Sears, and when Sears acquired Lands' End, because that catalog business was booming and had such great success. But it didn't take long for the value of Lands' End to be lost because of the changes to the business model imposed by Sears as it integrated Lands' End into their organization. And now Sears has closed its stores and I guess is back to what it was mostly in the beginning, an appliance store. Other examples would include one of my former employers, Ford Motor Company, who has had record-breaking success with the F-150 truck and the Mustang car platforms. And within these two platforms, the company has that secret recipe for creating even more award-winning, record-breaking sales vehicles. Yet, they fail to remove the internal barriers to that success and their ability to replicate the success of those two platforms. So whether you're a startup or an early stage company seeking angel and venture funding, a minority or a woman-owned business looking for working capital, or to be an acquisition target, your business is going to face challenges. And it's better wait to smart money that gets you and who you are and your vision and what you're attempting to do than risk destruction or loss of control of your business that you've worked so hard to build. Bias is going to be out there. And like I said, in the course of my career, well, I've worked with many business leaders, politicians, investors, business owners, and consultants. Sometimes the bias they have is the right bias to have. It's discernment. They have a preference toward action and innovation and sustainability. And these executives may not always say things the right way, but they do things the right way. Some of these executives and business leaders and politicians have called me honey, sweetheart, and darling. But it would be, honey, can you explain to this me? Darling, I think you're on to something. I remember one investor, a nice southern gentleman, highly successful, that called me as the CFO, and we'd just been doing a funding round for a spin out of one of the local universities. And he called and he said, darling, I think we're hemorrhaging money. And I said, yes, we are, and I don't even have a Band-Aid, and let's talk about what's going on. The company that I wrote about earlier had the dysfunctional diversity committee also had some outstanding executives who only cared about what you could do, not whether you were in heels and a skirt or wearing a tie. I can contrast them between two executives at organization. And it gets back to that honey and darling thing that I was just talking about with that investor. Both men were in their mid-60s with over 35 years of experience at that company. They had risen through the ranks together, and from the time they joined the company, they graduated from Ivy League universities. They were white and from the Northeastern United States. They couldn't have been more alike demographically. And neither of them ever called me by my first or last name, which was typically how they would refer to one of the men. So I would have expected to be called Lee or Strickland. And no, the most common means of address they used were honey and sweetheart. But the similarities between those two men ended there. I'm going to call them Bob and Gene. So my first encounter with Bob went something like this. Honey, sit down and be quiet and I'll tell you what to think and what your answers are. And if you haven't figured it out from listening to the show, that did not go over well with me. And I had just been promoted from my first job within this company to a division job. And I don't have a diplomacy, Gene. And I just fired back. I'm not your honey, babe, darling, or sweetheart. My name is Lee Strickland, and I am the finance representative on this team, and I'll tell you what funds are available. Well, it took me about 45 minutes to get back to my office from that after that meeting ended. And, I was the only woman in the room of over 100 people for that meeting. And when I got back, there were a lot of managers standing outside in my cubicle, and my manager's response was, "What were you thinking? Don't you know who he is?" And my response is, "Yes, I know who he is. I also know who I am. And my choices are to challenge him to respect me, or I can make a legal case out of it. Which would you prefer?" Well, we have to draw our lines. And remember, I said earlier that I'm always willing to look for a job somewhere else where there's not bias. Now, that was Bob. Now, Gene, he was a different character. He may have looked quite a bit like Bob and had the same background, but my phone would ring. About 6 o'clock in the morning, I'd be at my desk and I'd answer it. And it'd be Gene. And he'd say, "Hey, honey, can you come to my office and explain this report I just received? I'm not following all this analysis. And I need you to walk me through this and explain the critical parts." Me? "Yeah, sure, Gene. It'll take me 45 minutes to get to your office. I'll head out now." Did you get the difference? I think it was really apparent. Gene was old school. In his style of communication, his honey wasn't derogatory or demeaning. He called me honey like he would his granddaughter. And he recognized my expertise and he relied on it. How could I be sure of that? Well, the report he wanted help with, well, that he called me about wasn't even my work. I was his go-to expert on anything he needed to understand that was finance related. I wasn't the highest ranking person or a peer from the organizational structure. In meetings, though, Gene went out of his way to treat me with respect because he recognized my skill set. He respected my analytics. He respected how I would look at things and how I would tell him what I thought. I wouldn't lie to him, I wouldn't couch it in terms, and I wouldn't talk to him like he should have known this after 35 years. He also called me Little Red, after the then chairman of the board and CEO of the company. And he said I reminded him of Red. And that was a compliment, because he was comparing the skill sets and saying he could see me running that company someday. So you have to look beyond the surface of the words and the language. And Gene was a fabulous example of a business leader that recognized the difference in his team members. Still, the only thing that differentiated how he treated us was our business abilities. And Gene often told me that he had seen CEOs and other executives rise through the ranks. He could identify ones that would transform the organization and sustain it into the future. He said, "I would be one of them if the organization was willing." At the time, few women had risen to the senior executive roles, and most of those who had did so by transforming themselves to fit the culture. Back to that earlier diversity committee. "Do you think this woman would fit in our corporate culture?" Well, those who got promoted fit into the culture, and that was fine, but it wasn't necessarily the best thing for the business. And as Gene put it, sometimes the organization changes the person. And if the company is smart, it will allow a person or a group of people to transform it. And that's where the smart money is now. And that's where the smart funders are going to be. That's where the smart businesses to fund are going to be. They're going to be the people and the group of people who, well, make the changes, that are willing to transform. And ultimately, every organization has to make the decision about whether they're willing to be transformed and become more diverse. They have to determine whether the organization thrives, merely survives or dies an ugly death. Organizations stand at a decision precipice right now, and the question is, will they transform into sustainable, diverse businesses, or will they die under the biases of a lifetime? What do you think? You know, honestly, we have so much going on and so much chaos in our world right now, and so many people wanting to tear down what has been built up. And I have also been in the past known as the dynamite kid. And I'm all for tearing out the things that are systemically broken, that can't be changed. But I don't want to wholesale tear down every business that's out there and destroy them because of mistakes they may have made in the past. I think businesses can be transformed. I think eyes can be opened. And it begins with the process of who they hire, who they invest in, who advises the business. They need to get out of their comfort zones. They need to change the thought process about who they're going to do business with and how they're going to do business. How we've always done it this way is not something that you want to be saying in this day and age for a lot of reasons. Technology is an answer that we need to apply to our businesses. We need to remove and become aware of unconscious biases, prejudices, and discrimination that is not discernment. But we also have to realize that decisions for funding have to be made on the aspects of what's a sound business to invest in. If your business doesn't have the fundamentals right, if you can't talk the language of business, if you don't have your financial statements being produced, manage your business by the numbers, if you can't be the expert on your business, your industry, your competition, and what's going on out there, then why should anyone fund you? Not because you're black or you're white or you're male or you're female or you're young or you're old or any of those demographics. It has to be a business decision. The banks, when they make lending decisions for PPP and EIDL loans, make them on the numbers. What are your revenues? What are your systems? What did you look like beforehand? How well were you doing? What is the chance that you're going to be able to pay this back? What is the chance that you're going to be in business after these funds are given and spent and forgiven? What are you going to do? Are you going to transform your business? Are you going to find a new way of doing things? Are you a restaurant that's going to become an outdoor restaurant? Are you going to become delivery? Are you a supplier that supplied restaurants and now you're going to do home delivery? Are you going to change and have remote workers? And how are you changing your business model? How are you changing how you serve your customers? And who are your customers? Have they changed? If you can't answer those questions, not with just PPP loans and SBA loans, but any kind of funding you're looking for, if you don't have those answers, if you're not the expert in your business, and you're not an expert on your industry, why should anyone give their hard-earned dollars to you for your business? I'm going to advocate that diversity in business, that discernment in business, comes down to a root cause. And part of that root cause is an underserved community and unequal access to the tools and the education and the resources being delivered in a way that everyone has access to them, whether that's minority or women-owned businesses, whether that's underserved communities and historically underutilized business zones, opportunity zones, whatever it is. There's a skill gap. There's an experience gap. There's a language, business language gap that has to be breached. And the solutions that are out there for that, and I know I'm working on one right now in my business and with some partners, those business models have to be put out there. The equal access to educational resources for the entrepreneur, the would-be business owner in those communities, developing business models that work in those communities is critical. It's crucial. If we want things to change, then yes, everyone needs a part of the American dream. And I'm going to tell you, part of the American dream is financial security and control of your own destiny. Immigrants come here every day, and I would love to write a book about immigrant entrepreneurs and the impact they've had on this country through the centuries, and today especially. That they come in and they know that they have a chance here to compete, to go after their dream, to build the mom and pop shop on the corner, to own a dry cleaning, a coffee house, to innovate in technology and create vaccines and drugs, biologics, all kinds of different things that we're out there doing. It's amazing what can be done when we focus on the best parts of all of us and come together to make sure that everyone has the tools and the resources based on capability, based on vision, based on something other than the things that we can see. Or in our demographic. And I don't mean that to be flippant. But the fact is, I have friends from all kinds of ethnic backgrounds, from all kinds of religious backgrounds, and a lot of different political views. And we still are friends. We can have conversations. And yes, sometimes I get worn out from having the same conversations over the 4th of July picnic and talking politics or talking religion. But I still love them. I still believe in them, even if we're on opposite ends of the spectrums in our beliefs. You know something else? I know God loves them too. And that's what we have. We have to be focused on what makes us the same, what makes us alike, and value our differences, because those differences are what will take us further. I want to revisit that McKinsey study one more time in the fact. Companies that are led by ethnic, gender, and culturally diverse teams of founders and leaders are 15% more likely to generate profitability that is in the highest 25%, the top 25% of all businesses in their segments and their industries. So again, it's just good business. It's great business if you want to be successful to get a diverse leadership team. And what does that look like? Whether you're an investor or a founder or a company that's been around a long time, whether you're a mom and a pop or you're a corporation in growth mode, the more diverse your team is, the more differences in perspectives and experiences and education and backgrounds, and the more you can listen to them, the more that they have input, and it's not lip service input that you're asking but you don't do anything with it. The more those elements of that diversity come together, the better your decisions are going to be, the better your opportunities are going to be, the better your results. Imagine transforming your business from a one-note business with everybody the same into a symphony with all the different instruments coming into play. And what does it sound like? It's richer. It has more variety. It has more passion. It has more. And so that's what our businesses need to be achieving. We need to, either in the businesses or who we surround ourselves with in mastermind groups, in our vendors and our consultants and our advisors, our funders, in every aspect of our business, we need to look for diversity. We need to be consciously aware of our decision making, of our hiring practices, of our interviews and screening practices, and of our assumptions as to what our business needs and what that looks like, literally and figuratively. Our businesses will be stronger the more diverse they are. Our organizations will grow more the more diverse they are. Young and old, rich and poor, Northeasterner and Southerner, Midwesterner, Pacific Coast, Indian, Irish, Scottish, African, African American, Caribbean, South American, Australian, you name a country, you name an ethnic background, you name a religious background, you name any aspect that defines who we are and what makes us who we are, and bring that diversity to that team and value it. Listen, ask the right questions. Ask questions about your assumptions and how you make decisions, how you define who you're going to recruit. And be aware when you're in those sessions hiring somebody or interviewing somebody to invest in or seeking somebody to invest in you, that the differences will be better. I've had so many more male mentors than I have female mentors. It's been a part of my life. I look up to my uncle and my dad, who had businesses in different times. My dad, college educated, an engineer, a land surveyor, certifications in professional engineering. My uncle, an entrepreneur and real estate company. I mean, it was just growing up, there were all kinds of different people in my family and around my family that were business owners, grocery stores, service businesses, gas stations, coal miners, just name it. That diversity made a richer background. I worked in so many different businesses, and to that extent, I'm more millennial than boomer, but I was always looking to learn something more, and that more made my background so much richer. I have a broader perspective when I'm solving problems and I'm considering things. In my retail store, one of my first jobs out of undergrad, I applied manufacturing just-in-time concepts to retailing, to inventory control. And I had a store profitable in 8 months that was supposed to not be profitable for 4 years. I learned so much about people based on who was recruited to work with me, and whether I had all men working for me that were older than me, or all women that were older than me, or ethnic groups. That diversity gave me a rich experience that enables me to do more in my business and for my clients' businesses. So embrace diversity and stay focused on the important things. You've been listening to WCOM FM 103.5 LP, Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Focus on Business, and I'm your host, Lee Strickland, and I hope you will join me again next week for another Focus on Business. And until then, be safe, be happy, be focused on the important things. You're listening to WCOM FM 103.5 LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro.